Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Damian Pelliccioni, perhaps best known as the CEO and co-founder of the online streaming service Reverie, and the co-founder of QueerX, Hollywood's first LGBT web fest. Welcome to the show, Damian.
Thank you so much for having me, Art. This is such a pleasure.
You're quite welcome. As you know, I've spent the last couple of years documenting stories of gay bars all over the country, that most of which no longer exist. I'm up to over 1,500 that have been documented and had their logos digitally reconstructed. And as part of the video series, I've been interviewing everybody from movie makers to celebrities to bar owners to patrons to capture individual stories about the bars that played a part in their gay history. So having said that, I would like to kind of delve into a little bit of your history with gay bars. And I know that your first gay bar experience was in the Big Apple. So why don't we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I'm Damian Pelliccioni. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Reverie. My pronouns are they, them, theirs. I'm Hollywood's first non-binary CEO. It's funny that you asked this question first because it brought up a lot of fuzzy memories. I was originally from Toronto, Canada, and I got into a theater arts program at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And this was January of 2000. So I was only 19 years old. I just turned 19 in March that year, 2 months after I moved to New York City. And I was coming out for the first time. I didn't really start coming out until after high school. I think when I got to the Big Apple and when I got to New York, that was the opportunity to feel liberated, so to speak. And I was working as an intern at Abrams Artist Agency, one of the bigger talent agencies. And of course, my boss was gay. And a lot of their clients were LGBTQ, all different kind of members of the community. And there was one person, Guillermo Diaz, who's a pretty famous actor now, who actually invited me to meet him at a gay bar. I don't think he knew that it was my first time going to a gay bar. And this place doesn't exist anymore, but it was called the G Bar in Chelsea. And for those who are listening or watching who remember G Bar in Chelsea, it was more of like a hangout, cruising type of bar, not so much a dance floor or dance club, because the bar was right in the middle and people would just kind of line up around and kind of in their own little cliques. And there were some tables in the front. But it was a little intimidating when you first walked in. Like, I remember, like, oh my God, where is he? How do I find him? Okay, I guess I just look around this kind of dark bar for, Guillermo. And, eventually found him, but I was kind of nervous walking in. And then afterwards, that became like the regular bar we would always go to with other friends as well. So it was kind of like an interesting moment in time. And I had a fake ID, of course. I'd kind of outsmarted the system. I brought a fake Canadian ID with me because I'm originally from Toronto. I'm kind of guessing that the bouncers wouldn't know what a Canadian ID looks like. And of course, it worked. For the first couple of years, I was able to get into all the clubs and all the bars.
I cannot tell you how many people that I have interviewed about, their gay bar experiences who have told me that their first gay bar experience involved a fake ID.
I'm sure it's a common thread.
And it seems that whether it was in the 70s or the 90s or the 2000s, that gay bars were either more lenient about letting people in because they knew that a lot of these people had nowhere else to go, or if it was just that, gay people were a little bit more devious about actually getting, fake IDs that would get them into the bars. Now, the one thing I remember about G, when I first started researching these bars and I discovered G in New York City, was a series of ads that I ran across that was promoting their Friday nights. And their Friday night activity, and I'm not sure if this is why you were going there, was called Hung, H-U-N-G. And apparently, featured a lot of barely clad men running around, dancing around, and entertaining the patrons. Do you remember that?
Barely, but the name sounds familiar. Although that could be the name of a lot of gay bar promotions, I feel like. And I have a story about a funny one in LA afterwards. But yeah, I may have gone on Thursday, Friday, or Saturday or Sunday for sure.
Yeah, and the bar scene in New York was, you know, a little bit different back then. You had a lot of cool options. It's kind of moving around now a little bit. After COVID, it kind of closed down some places and put some places into slow motion. But yeah. The New York bar scene has always been, in the gay bar scene, has always been kind of vibrant and entertaining. So I've always enjoyed going there and exploring the different types of bars that you could see in different parts of town. And I'm glad you brought that one up, because no one has spoken about about G so far in this series. So,
oh, that's so funny. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, you were there around 2000.
Right.
How long did you go there?
Oh, gosh. So I only lived in New York City from 2000 to 2002, January 2000 to like actually October 2001, after 9/11. I made the move to Los Angeles, kind of on a whim. I decided to go to LA for an actor showcase, of all things, that I had, you know, purchased and planned kind of that trip back in, I want to say it was like July or June of 2001. So then 9/11 hit. And at that point, I was like, why not just move there? So I ended up moving there. So I would say I stopped going to G Bar right after 9/11. And ended up, you know, in Los Angeles. And now I am literally this week celebrating 20 years of living in Los Angeles, which is crazy how fast time flies.
It absolutely is. And I guess in the industry that you're in, Los Angeles is an excellent place to be. So it was a fortuitous decision to decide to relocate to Los Angeles.
Now, yeah, absolutely. I do not regret it. It's definitely home now.
And not to mention, in my opinion, the weather there is much nicer than New York.
You know, it's funny. It totally is. But I always miss New York. I'm in New York at least 3 or 4 times a year, and not just for work, also for pleasure.
So you moved to California. You were in your early 20s, and you still had memories of your experiences at G-Bar. And you're looking around trying to find a home, a gay bar home in Los Angeles. Which one did you stumble upon that really became part of your gay nightlife at that time?
So in my early 20s, obviously being an actor in Los Angeles, everyone worked at restaurants. So that was, I think, the first 8 years of my life in LA, I always had a restaurant job. Even if I had an industry job, I always kept that to make some extra cash. Plus, I loved the camaraderie and the family and the friends that you know, would create as working at a restaurant does. And one of my first jobs was at the Cinegrill at the Roosevelt Hotel. I opened that. It was the kind of jazz nightclub. And even still to this day, I have some amazing close friends that I am still very connected to. And our bar of choice that we would go to after work, if it was in West Hollywood, was Motherlode. One of my friends who I worked with, Charlie, was really good friends with the bartender. And the bartender, we would go on like the awkward nights. We would go on, you know, like a Tuesday or a Wednesday where they had half price shots or half price pitchers. And it was really an exciting moment because obviously, you know, when you're young in your 20s, you're on a budget and it's all about like the cheap beer. But they had karaoke night, I think on like Wednesdays, if I remember correctly, and Tuesdays was like the half price pitchers. And we would just go and hang out with the bartender and all of our friends. And there was a pool table, but it became our dive bar. It became our dive bar. And really, honestly, we went because of, you know, this one bartender whose name escapes me right now. I think he even still works there to this day. But, you know, it was kind of our dive bar community bar that we would just go hang out with friends at. And we did that, you know, I would say that was my first big gay bar outside of the, you know, the obvious. Everyone goes to the Abbey. The Abbey is like a rite of passage. David Cooley is a friend, and I love everything that he has built for the community year over year. And we continue to support the Abbey, even with our business with Reverie. I just feel like that's like the tourist place that like, it's kind of a rite of passage. You land in LA, the first place you go is the Abbey. And if you're leaving LA, I've gone to so many going away parties, it ends at the Abbey. But Motherlode was kind of the place that we would go and hang out and make it our own. We liked kind of, you know, that underground dive bar scene. And we had such a great time.
You know, Motherlode was one of those bars that had been around for a good while in Los Angeles. And in fact, I believe the location previously was another gay bar called the Rusty Nail before it was Motherlode and before you were there. They closed down for a while during COVID, but they have they reopened officially or?
You know, I don't know. It's so funny with everything I do with Reverie. I don't have very much of a social life anymore. Not like I did when I was in my 20s. I'm in my 40s now. So it was, I'm hopeful that it's still there.
Yeah, I know it's still there. And I saw an article a few months ago that said that they were preparing to reopen. I just never discovered for sure whether they had actually reopened. But it's kind of an iconic Los Angeles bar. Now, what do you remember about the decor and the design of the bar itself? I know you described it as a dive bar, so I'm guessing it wasn't very beautiful inside.
No, I do remember you walk in, there was always the magazine rack with all the free bar magazines, the free condoms and a giant fishbowl. You would turn to the left, there was a smoking patio right immediately to the left and to the right. It was kind of like a little box. So it was kind of indoor, outdoor. And then a long bar all along the right side. And then there was a step up to a smaller bar kind of up on a podium area where there was a bar table. And I do remember the bathrooms in the back, and I'll tell you why. I remember the men's bathroom was one giant trough. And on the wall, it was like as if someone had clipped out magazine clippings from like gay porn magazines of like naked men, and it was like just stuck on with glue, and it would line the entire wall. So yeah, talk about a dive bar.
After you've been going to Motherlode for a while, I guess you outgrew it a little bit, or you found a new favorite haunt.
It's funny, as I moved, it's funny, LA is so much of what you do and who your friends are revolves around the geography of Los Angeles. You know, it's unlike New York City where everything's in a grid and, people will travel on the train. In Los Angeles, it almost feels like, you know, just a smattering of suburbs. So I moved to the east side of LA. I moved to Silver Lake, Los Feliz area. And that was kind of like the alternative, cool, hip, you know, Williamsburg West, if you will. And I found kind of my tribe there. I was, you know, someone who didn't fit into the mold of West Hollywood back in that time. Probably still don't today. I was very much the alternative artsy kind of crowd, music, grunge, punk, you know, disco, dance, artists. That was us. And that was kind of the very Chelsea Hotel-esque type of tribe. And the place that I would frequent was MJ's. MJ's no longer exists. Was on, Rowena Boulevard over in Silver Lake, right across from a Gelson's and a Trader Joe's. But it was a big dance club, and it was where all the alternative kids went and the drag queens, and they had go-go boys. And I eventually got asked to work there, and I was their head of marketing. It was one of my first marketing jobs. And I was also hosting on stage. I hosted a Tuesday night called Rim Job. I didn't pick that name. It just happened to be the name of the night. It was actually one of the busiest Tuesday nights in Los Angeles for the gay bar scene. And it was a lot of fun. And they had performances and contests and go-go boys and cheap drinks. And, you know, it was the place to be on a Tuesday night. But MJ's became really popular and they did lots of different events and parties and celebrity driven stuff there. And I got to actually, and this is a great story. The first thing that my boss, Chris Perry, had me do was lead the AIDS walk team for the bar and asked me to go to the AIDS walk, team leader workshop. And so I did, and with the intention of kind of getting, maybe drumming up some business and getting some of these teams to come do their fundraiser at the bar, and we would donate back. And so I created flyers. I went to the workshop, and then I was also leading, you know, the bar's team. Of course, we put together our own team and raised funds and walked the AIDS walk. It's a big community driven event. But it's not necessarily all gay though. You know, AIDS walk can be very corporate. Like you have the employee resource groups from like, you know, NBC or like, you know, ABC or Disney, right. That would also be part of it. So, I was at the team leader workshop. I stood up and I told everyone, hey, here's a flyer. Come, you know, meet me. I'm the head of marketing over at MJ's and I'd love for you to, you know, host your fundraiser here and we'll donate back the bar. And that is where I actually met my husband, Christopher Rodriguez, who's also one of my co-founders of Reverie, was in that workshop that day on September 15th, 2007. And like I said, the workshop's not necessarily all gay people. So I wasn't sure if he was gay, but he came up and asked me for a flyer. And he had a little twinkle in his eye. And I realized, I'm like, oh, I think he likes me and I like him too. And so I gave him the flyer, gave him my number. So I didn't get his. And now this, I'm going to date myself. He ended up messaging me about a week later on MySpace. I'm like, that really dates me in terms of technology. And I remember we were messaging back and forth and that's where we set up our first date. And our first date, ironically enough, he wanted to go to MJ's. So we met at the bar that I worked at and we had a wonderful date. And that was 14 years ago. We're actually celebrating 14 years together. And we are actually legally getting married next week on October 22nd in Niagara Falls.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So obviously MJ's played a role in your life bigger than some of Absolutely. The other bars because
the biggest. You know,
It's where you met the man that you've been with for 14 years. So Correct. Congratulations yeah. on that.
Yeah.
Now, MJ's, as far as the layout and the concept of the bar, what was it like inside?
Oh, gosh. You know, it's funny. It's since become this bar called Tenants in the Trees. And I hesitated walking in there for a long time. I don't think I walked in there until about 2-3 years after that bar had opened. Because I, you know, didn't want to tarnish the memory of what the inside looked like. But you would walk into MJ's, immediately to the left, there would be like, well, smoking section. That's where they had the check-in door. And you would go right into a giant kind of warehouse nightclub with a big floating bar in the middle. Bathrooms on the right-hand side, a pool table, and then a dance floor just up to the right of the bar with an elevated DJ and this amazing, you know, lighting system. And then there was even a giant patio in the back with its own, you know, bar and TVs along the wall. It was a really exciting, at the time, probably what felt like big space. Today, I'm sure it probably feels small, but big space. And so many memories I have over the years. You know, I worked there for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, of that space and all the, you know, really fun events that we had hosted and put on and you know, all of the folks who kind of frequented that space, some of which I, you know, I'm still friends with or work with today.
Awesome. And then you also have another bar in the LA area that you mentioned to me was important to you, and that one is Akbar.
Yes. So it's funny because, and was it, Akbar is also in Silver Lake, and Akbar is still going strong today. Akbar is a staple. I mean, I was just watching, actually, ironically enough, Special on Netflix, and they feature Akbar as part of the storyline. It was my family go-to bar. Ever since I had moved to Silver Lake and Los Feliz, even before I got the job at MJ's, I was always going to Akbar. It is a hipster scene. It's a really mixed crowd of artists and musicians and filmmakers and actors and writers and directors and, you know, people who work in technology and in design. It is such a melting pot of everybody and all age groups and body types. And, you know, it was one of the most accepting places. Women, allies, lesbian, you know, everybody goes there. It was queer. You know, I love using the word queer. We use the word queer quite a bit. I know certain generations find that offensive based on, you know, the time that they were brought up. But queer is kind of a new way that we can empower and define our culture. You know, Reverie, we believe that we are defining the culture of queer. It's not about sexual orientation or gender marker. And it includes allies. Allies are part of queer culture. We wouldn't exist without allies. And so, you know, Akbar has just always, I've so many birthdays, so many New Year's Eves, Halloweens. Like, I have friends, I've been friends with those owners and, you know, the staff there for years, decades, actually, over a decade, some of which, you know, I'm very, very close with. But anytime I go there, it's like our Cheers. You know, I always say it's like, it's the neighborhood bar. Any night of the week, I'm embraced. Anyone's there, we have a history with. And it's just kind of the go-to, and it's the funnest dance, dance scene, I think, because they play like really cool alternative music and have really fun DJs, and they even have thematic nights, you know? And so it's, it will always be part of my history, and it still remains to be part of my history. And during the pandemic, they were the first one to really launch the, you know, the GoFundMe campaigns that you saw a lot of gay bars do. They were the first one to do that when obviously they were suffering during the pandemic from having to remain closed. And you could tell the love that is was given to that venue, because within 48 hours, they had exceeded their goal of $150,000. That's how many people did not want to see that bar go out of business. And today I can say, I know it's, you know, been remodeled and is since thriving.
Now, the, on the outside, Akbar is not particularly memorable from what I've seen the pictures of it. It just looks like a building. I mean, nothing going on there. But inside, they have kind of a Moroccan theme going on. They have detailed arches and multicolored tile inlays and all kinds of things like that. Do you have any idea where the name of the bar came from or why it was called Akbar?
You know, in all the years, I want to say probably 20 years almost that I've been going there, or 15 years, I don't think I've ever asked that question of anybody. I don't know what the inspiration of, now I feel like I want to find out the inspiration for the name of the bar.
I mean, I didn't know if the owners were some sort of, you know, Moroccan descent or something, or they just had a passion for that architectural style, but it's really attractive inside. We're going to put up a few slides showing the interior of the bar, and it is a stunning place. It really looks like it could be, super, you know, a turn of the century movie theater or something that has that, you know, grand architecture to it. And they're celebrating this year, I believe, their 25th anniversary. They opened in 1996. So they're one of the bars that has kind of bucked the trend and actually thrived for 25 years or more, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I assume you still go there when you have a chance to.
All the time. It's the go-to. That's our go-to now. That's the one place you will find me frequently, at least twice a month.
So if anybody's watching this and they want to stalk Damian Pelliccioni, they should probably go to Silver Lake and hang out at Akbar.
Go to Akbar.
Probably on a night that is not a weekend.
Yes. No, on weekday. Weekdays, school nights, I'm definitely at home in bed by 11 o'clock. But Fridays and Saturdays, you may catch me there shaking a tail feather.
Yeah, and that's another great bar that needed to be kind of included in our series of stories, because no one has spoken about that. Of course, they are still open, but you can't really archive the bars that used to be without including some that still are, because
that still exists. Yeah,
it's, you know, it's all part of that grand story. Now, when you first started going to gay bars, when you first went to G in New York, and you were kind of fresh off the boat, so to speak, from Toronto, what kind of feeling was that to be in a bar that you were surrounded by other gay people, other people that were, you know, accepting and non-judgmental and part of your clan? What was that like?
Yeah, you know, I think it's when you're, I was so young, you know, I was like 18, 19 at the time. First, it's a little intimidating, because it's like, you know, you're not supposed to be there because you're underage. So you're a little afraid about getting caught. And then, and especially I didn't have any fear of going by myself into these, entering these places, right? Which is kind of crazy for an 18 or 19 year old to try to get in on their own, not with other people, typically like a group. And I would say that, like, at first I was nervous. You know, I was more nervous about not getting found out as gay, but I think, like, what was the decorum, or what was the, like, what was the, you know, the speech or the proper etiquette? I don't think I, you know, had that experience just yet. But then you have a friend, obviously, who teaches you and shows you the ropes. And that was at the time, you know, Guillermo had taken me out a few times. And it was, you know, it was one of those things where eventually it just became the, not just a fun place to socialize and maybe meet your future boyfriend or partner, but get with friends and let loose, you know. I even remember actually going back to Los Angeles, thinking about those first kind of years, the first 2 years outside of Motherlode. There's another place that I frequent called Rage, and Rage still exists, but Rage had a Tuesday night hip hop night. And I would go every Tuesday, and my roommate was straight, who moved with me from New York. He would come with me, you know, to support, because he knew that, you know, I didn't have a lot of gay friends, none really in LA. A whole bunch of friends from work would go. And I ended up meeting a group of friends from Santa Barbara, who some I'm still remain really close with. And I would meet them there every Tuesday night and hang out and dance. It was a really fun night to dance. You know, but it's those moments of, like, letting loose and feeling free and feeling kind of invigorated to be authentically yourself without having to worry about any type of stigmatization. And I had no fear. My whole life, I've had no fear. I've had no fear of doing anything. That's, I think, what's brought me the most success in life, the greatest failures and the greatest successes in life. But everything has a balance. You know, I would say that if anything, being a part of those scenes during those times, you know, also gave me the confidence boost, you know, to not just leading my authentic life personally, but creating something much bigger in my professional life, which was to be working within our community. And now today, leading the largest LGBTQ television network globally.
Yeah, and Rage, yeah, you mentioned Rage. Rage actually closed this year, but the good news is it's in the process of redevelopment right now. And another well-known gay celebrity has taken over,
Lance Bass.
And he promises to bring us something fabulous. Several of the press clips that I've seen about it claim that it will be the most fabulous gay bar on the planet. I don't know. don't know exactly what that means or how he's going to accomplish that, but I am definitely looking forward to it, because in this time where we've lost so many bars because of COVID, because of you know, different apps that people use to meet and interact, and the change in society where not everybody goes to a gay bar as frequently as we did 20 or 30 years ago, our gay bar industry has suffered a lot. And it's really refreshing to see somebody, especially somebody who has some, you know, presence and some clout, going in and taking the chance on opening up a place that, you know, will be something fresh in that neighborhood. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what Lance has up his sleeve.
And you know what's interesting too, and I don't know if you've covered this in the series or not, there's a great documentary that's coming out about it, but about the decline even further in the lesbian bar scene. I mean, there's 15 active lesbian bars and clubs in the totality of the United States that still are open. And it's such a tragedy to see a lot of them close during the pandemic. But even the 15 that are still open are suffering themselves. But you don't see so many bars being reopened or retooled for women, you know, queer women within our community. And that's, you know, a tragedy.
Absolutely. But that's always kind of been the case from my experience. I went to my first gay bar in, I believe it was 1978. So it was before you were born. Even at that time, the lesbian bars were few and far between. I think historically, lesbians have less been inclined to go out to bars. And even when I lived in Atlanta in the 80s and 90s, the gay bars far outnumbered the lesbian bars. And even the lesbian-owned bars that existed in Atlanta very often made an effort not to be a lesbian bar. They often promoted the fact that men were always welcome and they wanted to have a mixed clientele. And I think part of that was because, at least at that time, you know, we would go out. When I first moved to Atlanta, which was 1983, it was not uncommon to visit 10 or 12 bars in the course of a week. And to be out five or six nights a week.
Right.
I mean, school nights or not, you went out. After dinner, you went to a gay bar, had a couple of drinks with some friends, and then went home. Because that was your social life. There was no, you know, public opportunity to interact with other people who were queer. So that's where you went. And I never really saw as much of that activity in the lesbian world. There are several websites. There's one website that I look at frequently called Lost Women's Spaces, and they spell women with Y. And they have cataloged quite a few lesbian bars all around the country and across the world. But in the course of my research, it's been difficult because you rely on what we call the bar rags to document a lot of the bars. That's where the ads, the listings and everything were. And many of the lesbian bars never advertised there, or, you know, they had such a tiny little listing somewhere that they were easily overlooked. Whereas the gay bars, and you can look at West Hollywood as a perfect example. When you first moved there, you probably saw full page ads from bars everywhere. You're like, oh my God.
Oh yeah.
You know,
Odyssey Magazine, Frontiers Magazine. Yeah. All the bar rags that don't even exist anymore.
So, and I don't know off the top of my head of any lesbian bars or women's bars or whatever they're identifying as that are opening now. I can't think of a single one that's a new bar. There's several queer bars. So actually one, next time you go to Manhattan, you have to go to Hell's Kitchen and you have to visit Q.
Oh, I keep hearing about this one. And it's funny, I'm in New York next week.
And you will love
so I
it.
Definitely want to check out Q.
Did you ever go to an event in New York City called West Gay at the Westway?
No, I did not attend that event.
So it was an ongoing event that was promoted by a guy named Frankie Sharp, who is like the king of the underground grunge punk gay scene in New York for probably 10 or 15 years. He did a lot of different parties and promotions at different clubs. And he is one of the two promoters that partnered with the owner of Boxers in New York.
Boxers.
The three of them together created the Q concept. And then they brought in a couple of high-profile celebrity investors who were friends of theirs, including Jake Shears. He's an investor in the bar. Charlie Carver from Teen yep. Wolf. He's yep. an investor in the bar. And Billy Porter.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's really cool.
And if Billy Porter is not the personification of queer, I
oh,
don't
absolutely.
Know who it is.
He's my favorite. I absolutely adore Billy.
And he is a partner in the bar as well. But from what I've heard from Frankie, we interviewed him just before they opened back in June. And the last 3 months have been so fabulously successful there that they are actually getting together and opening a new gay bar in the same general vicinity in Hell's Kitchen that is scheduled to open around November 1st. So,
oh, wow.
You're going to love it when you go there. Frankie,
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's an amazing facility.
I'm really excited. No, I keep seeing Instagram posts from so many different events that they've held since Pride that I'm dying to go check out.
It's a 3 or 4 story facility, 3,000 square foot bar on the top floor. I mean, I'm sorry, 3,000 square foot dance floor on the top floor.
Wow.
They have a cabaret area on the main floor that they spell with a Q, by the way, Q-A-B-A-R-E-T.
I love that.
And Frankie confirmed to me when we did the interview that the Q in the name of the bar stands for queer, because yep. he is an absolute proponent of embracing everyone. It's like a Studio 54, but without
yep.
without the you know, judgment.
So, absolutely. And that's why we use queer when we're marketing our channel.
Yeah. So you'll absolutely love it. And it fits perfectly with your mindset of how, you know, how it should be.
Yeah.
So when you started
going, check it out.
Obviously, when you started going to these clubs, you had no idea that your professional career would lead you into the rainbow permanently. you probably yeah. had no clue that
None.
10 or 20 years later that you would be gay 24/7 in every aspect of what you do in your life.
Yes, absolutely. I love the way that you put it. Yeah, I had no idea. You know, look, I've always worked as, you know, first I started off as an actor, then I went into producing, and then from there I went into startup and technology, specifically technology and entertainment. And throughout my professional career, you know, had you asked me, oh, you know, when you're older, or told me this statement, you're going to be the CEO of the world's largest LGBTQ television network, I would have said, yeah, you're crazy. You're smoking a ton of pot, buddy. And it's funny because, you know, today being, I just turned 40 this year in March. I have to say that I am the greatest at what I do, humbly speaking. And I love what I do because I'm being in service, not just to my community, but to communities, you know, here in the United States, but communities across the world. You know, Reverie launched at San Francisco Pride in 2016. Myself and 3 of my co-founders, Leah J. Daniels, our COO, LaShawn McGee, Chris Rodriguez, you know, had created and self-printed our own like t-shirts and went up to Dolores Park in San Francisco, because for everyone who knows, everyone parties in that park the Sunday before Pride. And we handed out flyers, I think like 1,000 flyers that day with, you know, Reverie on it and how to download the app. People were asking us, oh my gosh, like what street marketing team do you work for? I'm like, no, I'm the CEO, that's the COO, that's the CPO, that's the CBO. And then like by the end of that day, people were coming up and taking photos with us and asking us about the app and downloading it and telling their friends and sharing it on social. And we had been connected randomly through a friend of a friend of a friend to a writer from Macworld who wanted to do a story. And we actually did the interview, and then it came out about a month later, end of July, beginning of August. And then we exploded on the scene, had instantaneous downloads and messages and articles in 10 different languages, and Reverie kind of took off to the races. You know, today we are reaching over 300 million households and devices. We have channels on everything from Samsung TV to Comcast. You know, all the usual suspects, Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire. You can watch our broadcast channels or our direct consumer app. Just type in Reverie on virtually any search bar on any device and you'll find us. And our team is about 35 people based here in LA, but we do have now folks over on the East Coast and in different parts of the country who work for us, and we're expanding rapidly. We're actually going to be hiring another 10 to 15 people in the next 6 months to meet the demand, because there's obviously an opportunity there. But I think the most rewarding and exciting thing that I have had the pleasure of being a part of is the response from the community on what we have built, and realizing what we built is so much bigger than myself. And I'll give you a quick little aside story here. We had licensed this one queer, lesbian, Hindi and English title from Bangalore back in 2017 from a great independent filmmaker, Harini, who's a good friend in London. And it exploded. We had all this traffic from India. We couldn't, figure out why. It was only because of this one title that we had. We eventually acquired that title. But what was interesting is, cut to 2 years later in 2019, I had the pleasure of being a keynote speaker at Kashish, the LGBTQ Film Festival in Mumbai. And I flew out there, first time in India, first experience also, ironically enough, I can tell you about a gay bar in India afterwards. The first night at the opening reception, they had all the speakers come up and just, say, "Hey, I'm Damien, I'm with Reverie, come see me talk at 2 o'clock on Friday." And at the reception, all these queer female filmmakers from India were like lining up to talk to me. And I was kind of, in shock. Like, I was like, what's going on? Why are these women want to talk to me? And one of them showed me her phone and turns on her Tinder. And she's like, "I just want to show you the impact Reverie's having from our community as queer women here in not just Bangalore, but all over India." I'm like, "What do you mean?" She funnels on Tinder for lesbian, and all of the images in the grid were images from The Other Love Story. It was how lesbians and queer women in India identify themselves in fear of, being found out by their place of, worship or their home or their families, because for context, India only decriminalized LGBTQ people in 2018. So they had just had their Stonewall moment a year ago before I had been there. And I cried. It made me realize that what we were building was having tremendous impact on communities in parts of the world we've never even had a chance to interact with. And luckily I was, having this opportunity. And I always say it's greater than winning an Oscar or an Emmy, because the opportunity there is you're seeing the fruits of your labor and the impact that your business is having at a much bigger scale than you had probably ever anticipated. Every entrepreneur will say, "Why do you do what you do?" It's because I want to change the world. It's the kind of the old adage from Steve Jobs, from the old marketing days of Apple in the 90s. And I do believe that what we're doing and the work that we're doing is changing the world for the better in the way that people see our community. And media has that power. And I am really excited to be a pioneer in that space.
I know exactly where you're coming from. I've done interviews with people in all different walks of life and, had similar conversations about the impact of their work on the gay community or the queer community. Having come out decades ago, gay is my equivalent in my head.
Absolutely. Queer. Yeah.
But all different walks of life, all different people in the community who have made an impact. And recently I had a similar conversation with Todd Stevens.
Yes.
I'm sure Todd, where his movie Edge of 17, which came out about the time that you're moving to New York. It was, an early gay coming out movie. And then from there, basically his entire career being gay filmmaking. Alan Broca, same way.
We love
I'm not
Alan.
Sure he's ever produced anything that isn't gay. And all of these people, have had some sort of an impact on the way the world perceives the queer community. And it's all through media. It's all through, people don't read. I mean, people who are really interested in a specific topic may read a book. But in general, the world at large is not going to read a coming out story of a 17-year-old boy in Sandusky, Ohio. It's just not going to happen. But the entertainment industry has brought a lot of that to the forefront. I recently interviewed Jason Caceres, you know, great actor. I think almost every role he's ever played has been a gay character. And he's embraced that thoroughly, and he's very happy with it. And then you go back to people who are way before that time. One of the earliest interviews I did was with Bruce Valanche.
Ah, we love Bruce. He just wrote, Bruce actually just wrote as a comedy consultant for the Queer X Awards, which just aired on our network on Monday.
Yeah, is there an awards program that Bruce Valanche has not written for?
I mean, that's true.
The Oscars, the Emmys, everything. I don't think there's a single one out there that he hasn't somehow worked on.
Been a part of.
Going all the way back to the early days of Bette Midler.
Yes. So, and I call him Uncle Bruce. I call him Uncle Bruce.
He is a great, great guy. We had the best conversation. So Reverie, which I'm going to put up the slides and the links anyway, but it's spelled R-E-V-R-Y.
Correct.
And it is an absolutely amazing concept that we can have basically our own gay network that's accessible to people everywhere on the planet that has internet.
Correct.
And has so much gay programming on there that, you know, I mean, the sky's the limit. There are so many more things that could be brought onto that network over time as more and more people, you know, interact with you and your team and all these gay historical movies that are out there. There's Robert Camina has some great movies that he's done on gay history. I mean, there could even be a gay history channel that had nothing but gay history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there should be a show about it.
There should be.
Just like this one.
And, you know, I know how hard it is to put these things together because I actually only started doing these video interviews a little over 6 months ago. It's been about 6 months and 2 weeks. And this episode is actually episode number 51.
So, 51. Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you. And it's a tough job tracking these people down. And you're the perfect example. I think we've been working on scheduling you for about 3 or 4 months.
But that's my crazy schedule. I apologize.
But the way I look at it, it's our history and the project isn't stopping. I'm not on a time deadline that I have to do this one by March 1st or it's not going to happen. And so I'm just glad to be able to get the information out there. And that, like you said, the really rewarding part of this, I'm not getting rich doing this. I'm not having people throw money at me and saying, hey, you know, this is great. But almost everybody that I've interviewed and a lot of people that have just seen the posts online have made comments to me about how important it was to them and how much it warms their heart to hear these memories of the places that were important to them, or that they've heard about from other people, or that somebody's out there preserving the memories of the bars. Because so much, as you know from, you know, your experience in the entertainment industry, so much of our history that's been recorded focuses on the riots, the revolutions, the politics. All of that is documented everywhere. But the bars, people just, you know, they just started to vanish from our memories. Nobody was talking about them. And so that's why I'm really glad that the, you know, the Lesbian Bar Project and the Gay Bar Archives Project and all of these archival projects around the country are starting to look more into, you know, the bars, which were really the center of our communities 20, 30, 40 years ago. So it's been a great experience for me. And it's been really cool talking to people like you who have your own experience from your own, you know, set of memories, different cities that you lived in or experienced things in, because that's what brings the whole picture together. You know, I can't do it on my own. I can't go and visit every bar that ever existed and have a memory from it. And if I did, nobody would want to hear me talk for, you know, 100 hours about all these bars. So it's really nice to have a variety of people be able to share their memories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you mentioned that you're the first non-binary CEO in Hollywood.
Correct.
And as everybody has probably noticed during the duration of this interview, you're proudly wearing the future is non-binary t-shirt.
Correct.
So what does non-binary mean to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, non-binary is not being put in a box of a gender, whether it's male or female. I think that gender is a social construct that has not really developed as much as we wanted it to, I think, over time. And I think because of that, as a result, we see a lot of bullying, we see a lot of fear, we see a lot of hate that comes from gender inequality, and specifically, transgender folks who have the hardest time, harder than cisgender folks. And I chose to take a stance and come out as non-binary because, you know, I've questioned my own gender multiple times throughout my life, even though I was born cisgender male. And I still will answer to he and him pronouns. That doesn't offend me in any way. But because my, belief is that, when you look at future generations and we look at ways to kind of even the playing field, non-binary people and non-binary gender markers are an opportunity to do that. So we don't have the same inequality that we do based on gender that we have had historically here in the United States. Sometimes you'll see me wearing a fabulous dress and heels, and other times you'll see me presenting what is known as more male. Some of my biggest fashion inspirations, we talked about Billy Porter earlier, they have such a unique perspective on fashion as it relates to gender. And that has really been empowering to see a celebrity at that level, Jonathan Van Ness included, really come out and embrace their femininity and their divine feminine self. And I am doing that and finding my pathway through that for myself. And it started with taking this opportunity and declaring, my non-binary status.
Well, and so much of it, as you said, is social constructs that even over the decades and centuries have changed. I mean, almost everything that we consider right now to be a trapping of female gender, including wigs, high heels, dresses, stockings, all apply to men. Yep. And if you look back into the 16th, 17th, 18th century, those were even the color pink in Victorian times was considered too outlandish for girls. And boys were dressed in pink and girls wore pale blues and off whites because that was more demure and subtle. And the men were the ones who were allowed to be more flamboyant with their colors, with their jewelry. To this day, I think judges and attorneys in the British system wear wigs. It's a social construct that we have changed over the years. After the war, after World War II, women in the United States, it became very acceptable for them to wear pants and tennis shoes and t-shirts and things that were traditionally considered male. So,
correct. Yeah.
The whole concept that if you're wearing a pink dress, you must be a female is something that's evolved in our recent history, not something that goes back decades and centuries.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. And look, even them, the news blog recently came out with an article that just in the last year, over 1 million Americans are now identifying as non-binary. And I believe that this movement is going to continue to grow in scale. And non-binary people are part of this community. And really a part of kind of the shaping and the future of what queer culture is.
Absolutely. And, I'm sure in your programming, you're going to be bringing out more of that as well over the coming months. And what do you have working that we should get excited about? What's coming up on Reverie
Yes.
that that we just can't wait for. We're sitting on the edge of our seats looking forward to watching.
Well, first of all, you know, depending on when this interview comes out, last Monday, which was October 11th, National Coming Out Day, we aired the second annual Queer X Awards, part of our Queer X Fest. Queer X Fest runs all of September and October, and we play a ton of great festival content. And then we have our Visibility Award winners, which we honored this year, Bowen Yang, Michaela J, or MJ Rodriguez, Erica Wheeler, WNBA All-Star and player for the LA Sparks. And we also honored Elvira Cassandra Peterson, who recently came out as lesbian. The awards were, you know, we had a non-binary circus act and musical performance from Chanel and the Circus. Mila Jam, we played her new version of It's Raining Men, But It's Raining Zem music video, which is right in the middle of the show. And Alcés Carcion had a big show-stopping closing number. But it was the most exciting and biggest and best piece of content I think that the team has ever produced. You know, we had another big show this year with McDonald's, House of Pride, which came out during Pride season in June. The first show ever that McDonald's underwrote for this community. They even went so far and put us on the billboard in Times Square, which is really exciting. They put the Pork Bounders on that billboard, Leah LaShawn and Chris Knight. We got to see ourselves on the McDonald's, not just a billboard, the McDonald's billboard in Times Square, which is the third largest, right across from the Viacom building. Very exciting, altruistic moment for myself to see my face and plastered on a billboard that big. But really, you know, exciting content, you know, featuring so many people within our community, so many great artists, music, dance, drag, ballroom, comedians, you know, I'm very proud of the work that we've done on these two shows this year. And I think it's probably some of the best content that we have put out. But then there's so many things to discover. Great documentaries like Them, which talk about non-binary people, or Miss Rosewood about a trans, you know, performance artist from New York City from the Box, or, you know, so many amazing documentaries that I personally still to this day love to watch over and over and over again. You know, there's so much to discover on Reverie.
Well, we'd look forward to seeing all the exciting program. For anybody that has not visited Reverie.tv, you need to go there, check out the programming. It's amazing, the variety of program. You could spend hours and hours watching nothing but gay programming. And as Damian and his team, you know, continue to bring new programming in there, there'll always be something fresh to take a look at.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about some of your bar experiences and as well as, you know, your professional life. It's been really refreshing to hear some of these stories. So thank you so much, Damian.
Thank you for taking me down a trip down memory lane. This has been really fun.
And that concludes another segment of the Gay Barchives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gaybarchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.